Jody O'Sullivan from Washington University in St. Louis, and he will talk about information geometry, alternating minimizations, and transmission tomography.
Thank you, John. And I'd like to thank the organizers, in particular my good friend John Schottland, for inviting me. I think it's been a wonderful week, and the PIM staff has been great. And as we wind down, I think we should plan on doing this again in a couple of years. So let's keep that. Let's do that. So I'm at Washington University. This work is supported primarily by National Institutes of Health grant. That grant has PI Jeff Williamson, who recently moved from Washington University to VCU. And then these are various collaborators. In particular, Don Snyder has contributed to a lot of the ideas here. So I'm going to start off by reviewing the X-ray CT problem, and I'll review it from the viewpoint that we take. And so in the viewpoint that we take, we'll start with trying to understand the physics of the CT data collection. We'll try to write down a model for the statistics of the data that are available. And then we'll base our reconstruction algorithm on this statistical model. And in this viewpoint then leads to a maximum likelihood formulation of the problem. I'll formulate a general problem statement, which looks rather formidable, and then I'll take this side tour through some results from information geometry, I'll then return to the application after talking about alternating minimization algorithms. Alternating minimization algorithms are, of course, have the expectation maximization algorithm as the primary example. And what we're going to try to be thinking about as we go is how to, if we have a truth image like the one at the top, and those are some high-density objects in the middle, and if we use standard filtered back projection and we blow up that middle part, we get images like this. And if we're interested in looking at the tissue in the neighborhood of this high-density object, this isn't going to be any good. And so we have to think about doing something better. Why are we interested in that? Well, our grant comes from the National Cancer Institute, and we've been working on a problem in cervical cancer where there's a 50% survival rate. And so part of the problem is that they use this radiation brachytherapy applicator to put radiation adjacent to the cervical cancer. And the dose prediction is done by taking a scan of the patient prior to insertion of this applicator and then predicting where the anatomy moves after the applicator is in place, and then using that prediction of where the anatomy went to then do dose prediction, and then there's the usual trade-off of how much of the dose goes to the cancer versus nearby sensitive tissue. So one of the applications that we're thinking about then is to do a CT image after this object is in place and it has high density metal in it, and to in particular get high quality images of the tissue adjacent to this high density applicator. And some of our algorithms we throw in something we called object constrained computed tomography. It's object constrained because we know this object that we're putting in the patient, and we want to take advantage of the knowledge of that object if we can. So again, if that's the truth and this is simulated data, you just do filtered back projection, and this is the best filtered back projection we could get. Using that, we want to do something better than that. I should point out that our windows when we display these are fairly tight around water. It's sort of water plus or minus 10%. Okay, so let's go back and try to understand the transmission tomography problem as we see it. So we think of source detector pairs as being indexed by Y. Should I use the big pointer? Do you have a... Okay, so we'll think of source detector pairs as being indexed by Y, pixels being indexed by X, pixels or voxels in the 3D case. Our initial model is that we'll model the data Y as being Poisson distributed with means G of Y, and the G of Y is parameterized by the attenuation function of the patient. So then this leads to this log likelihood function, which maybe I should go to the next page and then come back. So if you have a Poisson distributed random variable, so if n is a Poisson distributed random variable with mean lambda, then the probability that n is equal to some value k is lambda to the k over k factorial e to the minus lambda. If we take the logarithm of that, we just get k log lambda minus lambda, and then there's this term that depends only on k. If we're interested in doing inference over lambda, this term doesn't matter. So we're just going to look at that. And so then that leads to the usual log likelihood function. We just sum over all the source detector pairs, the data, log times the mean minus the mean. And our model for the mean is, there's a source, an X-ray source, that has a distribution of energies. So this is a typical distribution of energies in an X-ray source. I think there's 120 kVp, and so there's this distribution of energies. That's this I-naught. This could depend upon the detectors, if you want to take into account detector efficiencies. But then given that an X-ray photon is emitted at a certain energy that goes through the patient, let's assume for a minute that goes along a line through the patient, then this is the usual line integral appropriately discretized. So this H is the point spread function of the line integral. So you can just think of this as a direct delta if you want. This is the radon transform. And that's through the attenuation function, which could depend upon the energy of the X-ray photons. We'll also include in the mean number of counts beta, which could be some background counts. In some cases, we'll use that to model scatter, particularly behind in the counts behind a high density object. Maybe all the counts are scatter counts. Okay, so this I naught here is the mean number of counts that you would get without the attenuation. This is the standard Beer's law. Then the attenuation function, we'll in general think about that being as a sum of constituent components. There have been some good arguments in the literature for this. Typically, the number of components is one or two. And then our estimation problem or our inference problem is, given this model for the data D, to recover the image, and the image is going to be this C. So if there's only one image, then we want to recover that. If it's a monoenergetic situation, that is, if this is an impulse at some energy, then there's no sum over energies here. This is just your standard radon transform. Then you would recover your estimate, your measurement of the radon transform by taking by dividing your counts D by I naught, and then taking the log and minus the log to get the radon transform. So this is the generalization of that. And in this generalization, we're interested in recovering one or more images here. And I say here we want to maximize this likelihood function, and that's completely equivalent to minimizing something called the I divergence. So what's this I divergence? If we go back to the simple case of a Poisson distributed random variable with this k log lambda minus lambda, the dependence on lambda is actually minus the dependence of this function on lambda. So there's a function of two variables, k and lambda, k log k over lambda minus k plus lambda. This dependence on lambda is the same as that. So maximizing this over lambda is the same as minimizing this over lambda. Or more generally, this is our log likelihood function for CT. And maximizing this over the attenuation function, appropriately constrained like on the last overhead, is going to be equivalent to minimizing this I divergence over the attenuation function as described on the last page as a sum of constituents. So then this is our problem, which is we try to start with an understanding of the physics, derive an objective function, and then this is our objective, is to maximize this log likelihood function over the constituents, which is then completely equivalent to minimizing this I divergence. So now let's go ahead and try to understand what it means to minimize this I divergence. So we're trying to minimize this. Where in here, the G, this is the G. In everything I'm going to say in this talk, I'm going to drop this beta, but our theory handles this beta. And so we put this up here and we say, well, this is a very nonlinear optimization problem. And so how can we hope to solve it? But let's try to understand what makes it difficult. What makes it difficult is that there's this log of G. There's a log of this sum. So that's a huge problem because, you know, if this sum wasn't here, then the log of the exponent, just this term drops out, and so we'd be much happier with that. So in the monoenergetic case, this log of the sum is not a problem. But that's not the only problem, because even in the monoenergetic case, the second term in the log likelihood function, it has this e to the minus this integral over through the attenuation function, or the sum through the attenuation function. So the fact that there's this sum in the exponent also makes this problem very difficult. So now I'm going to take this sidetrack and talk about information geometry. And then we'll come back and see how this plays a role in deriving algorithms for transmission CT. So let's just try to understand what this I divergence is and what some of its properties are. So in general, if we just have an I divergence of two vectors, P and Q, and so there's a sum over I, P log P over Q minus P plus Q. This is a non-negative function. So as we think about minimizing it, it's always going to be bounded below by zero. If we start at any finite value, as we start to minimize it, it will be bounded below. And if we get monotonically decreasing estimates, which we will, then we know that there's a lower bound. And so that actually the value of this I divergence will converge always in our algorithms. This is a generalization of relative entropy. And relative entropy is used widely in information theory. It's a measure of information. So in this sense, then, I divergence is a measure of information. It's a measure, you can interpret it in two ways. One is the amount of information that the data provide for inference about the attenuation function. Or you can look at it the other way and say, well, how much do variations of the, can we quantify the amount of information provided in the attenuations by the, in the measurements by the attenuation function? So this relative entropy is a measure of the discrepancy between two probability distributions it's the discrepancy between two probability distributions. Let me stop there. So, for example, you know, this plays a fundamental role in data compression. And mutual information is nothing but a relative entropy between a joint distribution and a product distribution. So, it also then is fundamentally related to data communication, etc. It's not symmetric in P and Q. There are generalizations of this by Imre Cizar. And it has some properties. I'm just going to hit a couple here, and then I'll get to the more important ones on the next couple of slides. So one is that if you think about having two vectors, P and Q, and then you were to pass them through something that's analogous to a channel, P is a probability matrix, then the P and the Q get closer. These two vectors become closer to each other if you project them through a probability matrix. So this is the notion of projection for these non-negative vectors, is multiplying by a probability matrix. There's another. This is a direct relationship between the I divergence and relative entropy. If we normalize the P's to sum to one and normalize the Q's to sum to one, this I divergence is nothing but the relative entropy between the two corresponding probability matrices. And so, in general, the I divergence is directly related to the I divergence between the relative entropy between the corresponding probability vectors. Okay, so if we think about minimizing I divergence and it's not symmetric in its two arguments, this is fundamentally different than minimizing least squares. So if you're minimizing squared error, the squared error is symmetric in the two components. And if we think about doing projections, we do think about doing orthogonal projections, and there's only one projection property, and that is, you know, that if you look at the distance from a point not in a linear family to any point in that linear family, so the distance squared, that distance squared is going to be equal to the distance squared between that point and the closest member of that linear family, plus the distance squared between that one that's closest and that other one. So it's just the Pythagorean identity. Well, in idivergence, it's not symmetric, so we have two projection properties. The first one is that if the first element of the idivergence is restricted to a linear family, so by being restricted to a linear family, we mean that it satisfies some linear equality. We'll assume that this hyperplane has a non-trivial intersection with the positive orthant. And suppose that any Q vector here is given, and this linear family up here is given. And suppose that there is some P star in this linear family that achieves the minimum, that is closest to Q in this linear family. It's like the orthogonal projection. Then for all other P in L, the idivergence between this arbitrary element of the linear family and this Q is equal to the idivergence between that arbitrary one and the one that's closest, plus idivergence between the one that's closest and this vector Q. So this is then the triangle equality in the first argument, and that holds when the first argument is in a linear family. For the second argument, this triangle equality holds if the second argument is in an exponential family. So we define an exponential family. So Q is in an exponential family parameterized by pi and some matrix B. If the elements Q sub I are equal to pi sub I times e to the minus the sum over, say, k of B sub ki, nu k. So there's some vector nu such that when you take b times nu and you look at the ith component, take e to that times this, then that's q. If this exponential family is given and p is an arbitrary element in the positive orthon, then if q star achieves the minimum over all members of this exponential family of this I divergence over the second component, then we have that the I divergence between P and any other element of that exponential family is the I divergence between P and the one that's closest plus the I divergence between that one that's closest and that arbitrary member. So I'm not going to give the proofs, but the proofs are actually duals of each other. And that's because these two problems of minimizing I divergence over the first argument being in a linear family and over the second element being in an exponential family, those two problems are dual to each other. And they're Fenchel dual in the following sense. So if you if you look at minimization of the second argument over being in an exponential family, that is dual to the problem of minimizing I divergence over the first element being in a linear family. And the second pi, that's this first element of this exponential family, sort of the nominal element of the exponential family. If we go back here, if all these nus were zero, then pi sub I, q sub I equals pi sub I. That's the nominal element of this exponential family. So it's the divergence between p and this nominal one. And then this linear family here is determined by this matrix B and this vector D. And then there's this equality that the resulting objective functions satisfy. And we could talk for a long time about that if we had more time. Information geometry is a growing literature on this. Sunichi Omari and Imre Chizhar have been two of the leading researchers in this area. As Omari likes to point out, there are two types of information geodesics corresponding to whether you're minimizing or the first or the second variable. There are these linear or what he calls M projections. There are these exponential or E projections. So he talks about manifolds as being either M flat or E flat. And M flat just means it's a linear family, and E flat means it's an exponential family. So another way of thinking about exponential families is if you take the log of a member of the exponential family, the log of that is going to satisfy one of these linear equalities. So those would be E flat or E projections, and there are lots of other things we could say about that. And this last comment just emphasizes that this duality between this last thing is something else. Okay, if you think about having a Let's just think about having a probability distribution that lives in an exponential family. So that exponential family I have, let's suppose that further we constrain it for all the elements to sum to 1. There are 2 dual parameterizations of an exponential of a member of an exponential family of probability distributions. One is through those parameters nu that I had on the last slide. So let's go back here. So one is through these parameters nu. Another equivalent parameterization of this exponential family is by the mean of the distribution over functions over these b's. So if you take the sum of the q sub I times b sub ki and you constrain those means, that's a dual parameterization. So there's dual parameterization between the means of these functions and the exponential family parameter. Okay, let's talk about alternating minimization algorithms. I've gone back and forth about how I like to present this, but in the past couple years I've been focusing on this very simple convex decomposition lemma, because I think it holds the key for understanding. If you understand this very simple lemma, then you can understand expectation maximization algorithms, you can understand the algorithm I'm going to present. So let's let f be an arbitrary convex function, and it's going to be defined on a positive cone. And let's suppose that these x sub I are in this positive cone, and then the sum of the x sub i's will also be in that positive cone. So the convex decomposition lemma says that a function of a sum of the x sub I is less than or equal to the sum over I, r sub I, f of 1 over r sub I, x sub I, where these r sub I are non-negative real values, that they're non-negative and they sum to 1. So that they form a probability vector. And the sum could be infinite. We can do this in terms of integrals. This holds for x being defined in fairly general spaces. Just this has to be a positive, defined on a positive cone. There's a one-line proof of this, and that's Jensen's inequality. And Jensen's inequality is we just put r sub I over r sub I in here, and then a convex function of the average of something is less than or equal to the average of the convex function. Okay, so that's Jensen's inequality. So a special case is the natural log. So if we have the log of a sum of things, then that is equal to minus the minimum over probability vectors. So these are just probability vectors. Notice the probability vectors form a special case of these linear families I was talking about. It's minus the minimum of p over probability vectors of p, sum of pi log pi over qi. This very simple convex decomposition lemma can be viewed as the basis for the expectation maximization algorithm. DiPiero has used this, and as have Lang and Fessler in various papers, talking about how to derive algorithms for various problems, including for computed tomography. Let me now talk about alternating minimization algorithms. And what we're going to do is we're going to use this convex decomposition lemma I just had to construct a new family of alternating minimization algorithms. So if our problem is defined as the minimization of some functional over q, then what we do is we derive a variational representation of that function as the minimum of some auxiliary function over a variable p, over some auxiliary set p. And then our result is that our original problem becomes a double minimization of this auxiliary functional over q and p. And this immediately leads to an alternating minimization algorithm where you pick an initial guess for p and then pick an initial guess for q, then minimize over p, and then fix that guess for p and minimize over q. And that's what this says. So we fix a guess for q, minimize over p, fix p at that last value, and then minimize over q, and then alternate. Even in this very general form, we get a guaranteed monotonicity of this cost function. And so if this cost function is selected carefully and has nice properties, then in fact you can say nice things about the convergence of such algorithms. Special case of interest to us is this I divergence I've been talking about. And the families over which we're going to minimize are exactly the first one being over a linear family and the second being over an exponential family. We then consider this very general problem of minimizing I divergence over the first being in a linear family, the second being in an exponential family. We just look at properties of this very general class of algorithms. And then we can ask, well, what algorithms fall within that class? And essentially all of our standard EM algorithms fall into this class, including Vardy, Shep, and Kaufman's EM algorithm for emission tomography, Blaehit's algorithm for rate distortion. Cheeser and Tuznati have talked about general classes of alternating minimization algorithms. The standard EM algorithm of Dempster, Laird, and Rubin and others falls in this class. Richardson and Lucy's algorithm for astronomical imaging, Cover's algorithm for maximizing log investment return, and then Miller and Snyder in a nice paper in the Proceedings of the IEEE in about 87 had a class of algorithms which fall in this as well. Let's come up with the most trivial example. So in a minute we'll talk about using this over images where they're 512 by 512 and maybe volumes in CT. But for now, let's suppose that we have two variables we're trying to optimize. Let's just try to get a little bit of an understanding. So we'll say the P is P1 plus 2P2 equals 2. This is our linear family. So that's this line over here. And then our exponential family is going to be Q1 is equal to e to the v and Q2 is equal to e to the minus v. So actually Q2 equals 1 over Q1, and so that's this exponential family. And let's suppose that our problem was this double minimization. So minimize over P in this linear family, minimize over Q in this exponential family. Then the algorithm says, well, you pick some initial value and you bounce back and forth and you minimize over Q and then minimize over P, and sure enough, if you blow that up, it converges to the global minimum. So these are the two minima. And what I wanted to just point out here is that if we look at the P value at the convergence point and look at the contours of constant I divergence away from that, these are those contours. If we fix Q and we look at the P at constant I divergence away from that, the contours look like this. And these contours look very different. And that's because that there's this asymmetry in the two components. How much time do I have left? Okay, so we can say various nice convergence properties about general classes of these algorithms. How can that help us with transmission tomography? Okay, so this was our original problem was we had here d of y, and then we had log d over g of y, where g of y was the sum of this over e. Well, that sum over e I can bring outside using the convex decomposition lemma, by saying, well, we're just going to minimize over this first element being in the linear family where the marginals are the data. So this linear family is defined by the data. And then the second family is just this model that I talked about earlier for the just your standard Beer's law model for the mean. So this is the mean number of counts at energy E. And we look at this function. So what we've done is we've transformed our original problem into a double minimization where the first one is over a linear family, the second is over an exponential family. And this exponential family, the parameters up in the exponent are the image. Those are the image or images that we're going to recover. And so we get this nice alternating minimization algorithm where our next estimate is equal to our last minus 1 over z sub I, and I'll say what z sub I is on the next page, log of a ratio of two things. What are the ratios of these two things? This is the back projection of P. It's the back projection of this P. This is the data. This is not the log data. This is not what we usually project. Okay, what we usually do is we take the data, we take divided by I naught, and we take minus the log of that, and we back project that. That's not what this says. This says we back project the original number of counts. That's the numerator. The denominator is just the back projection of our current estimate of the mean number of counts. So we can think of this as being the mean under the function, under the matrix that's up in this exponent. And this relates to that dual parameterization of an exponential family. The dual parameterization is over the means computed over functions of interest and the parameters that are in the exponent. I don't really have a lot of time, but let me just say something about how the algorithm is derived. I have this double minimization, and so it's over this exponential family. This is still a hard problem. And so the difficulty now really rests in this last term, where there's this exponent, this e to the minus of sum over x. So what I do is I introduce a z sub I of x over z sub I of x up here. The z sub I of x is chosen such that the sum over x and the sum over I of this h times this mu sub I. So this h and the mu sub I, this is the attenuation function of, say, a constituent component. This divided by z sub I of x is a probability, or is less than or equal, it sums to less than or equal to 1. And what we can then do is we can then apply the convex decomposition lemma again. And so what there's some details here on how we apply the convex decomposition lemma. But by having sort of a probability distribution up in the exponent, we can come up with there's an inequality. So this term right here gets upper bounded by this, and we take that, we substitute it in there, and then we're going to actually minimize an upper bound on our cost function, and then we'll push our cost function down. Okay, so let's go back to the applications. This is a simulation we did over a very long period of time. Our phantom is plastic on the outside, water, plastic, and then there are four rod phantoms in the middle. There, one's brass, one's iron, one's aluminum, and one is Teflon. And so I think the way it goes is that these two are aluminum and Teflon. And these two are the brass and the iron. There's a version of this using ordered subsets, which was mentioned earlier in the week, which I haven't just had the chance to describe here. And the ordered subsets, if we look at the convergence of the value of our cost function versus iteration number, the ordered subsets just pushes this curve to left, so it accelerates the convergence, and this is demonstrating that. You can see that I actually went out to a million iterations. This is 132 ordered subsets. That these ordered subsets algorithms will give you not only a speed up, but also they give you an improvement in the value of the function. This gives you a speed up of about a factor of 100. To make this clinically useful, we need to speed up by another factor of 100. So, Joram, if you can give us 50, we'd be happy. But we do. I'll talk a little bit more about some of the considerations that we feel we need to make. And notice that the streaks are almost completely gone here in all of these images, and this is in stark contrast to filtered back projection. So this is an example where if we actually knew this is the truth, and if we actually knew the position of this high density object and reconstructed everything else around it, we get good images. But after we insert that in the patient, we don't really know where it is. And so what we have to do is jointly estimate the position and orientation of this thing and the patient attenuation. And we get iterations like this. And it's very, very minute changes of this position orientation of this applicator. Because you can get it pretty close at the beginning, but you need to have far less than subpixel accuracy on that. And so this just shows, you know, for this types of algorithm, this is standard filter back projection, and we essentially get rid of the streaks if we know where the object is and we know what it is. There are lots of other issues that we're dealing with. Obviously, you often have to regularize these, particularly if you those examples that I just showed were actually monoenergetic cases. And if you want to estimate two constituent components, you're going to have to do a lot of regularization. This one we have been working on for the last couple years, and we have another version of this algorithm that takes this into account. And what this says is that In fact, detectors don't count photons. The detectors are actually energy integrating detectors, and so each photon that is measured contributes an amount to the measurement proportional to its energy. And we have this significantly complicates the formulation. So this is just saying that there's an underlying Poisson process in energy, and you measure the integral of the energy against this Poisson process. But we have a version of the algorithm that works there. We don't yet have a hope for computing it. We also, as I indicated by my questions to Yoram, we worry very much about detector size and pixel size and whether this high density object cut through a pixel or not. And often those are critical for accurately predicting the measurements. Scattering, we don't yet have a good way of iteratively estimating the scatter along with the attenuation function. Recently, based on the interest, I've changed my talk a little bit, added some recent work on limited angle tomography and region of interest. If you go to any commercial scanner, they don't tell you how they do beam hardening correction, and they're often reluctant to give you the data prior to the beam hardening correction. And until we can get that data, then our polyenergetic model that includes the energy dependence may not be. We've had limited success in using that on real data. So I just added these slides this week based upon some recent work, because there's been a lot of talk about region of interest tomography and limited angle. So what we've done here is to model directly. We just take exactly the algorithm I talked about before, and we just model directly the dependence of the measurements on the data. And this is our phantom, except for now we have air and water in there instead of Teflon. Instead of the high density objects. And so it's air, Teflon, water, aluminum. And the effect that we're going to get at here is this is rotated, but so you should think of this as being on the bottom and a patient lying on that. That's the patient bed. This is the actual patient, a model of the patient bed that we have in the Siemens scanner at Washington U. This is a model of a phantom. You'll see some real data from a phantom that this models in a minute. And the problem is that when the source is out here, the fan cuts off part of the bed. But when the fan is over here, it'll get, I guess when it's out there, it gets the whole bed. There's some angles where it gets the whole bed, and there's some angles where it doesn't get the whole bed. And so we found that we needed to modify our algorithm to take that into account. So if the board is inside the field of view, and we look at synthetic data and run our alternating minimization algorithm, we get nice images. This is 1,000 iterations with 22 ordered subsets. If the board is outside the field of view and we look at the synthetic data, do the alternating minimization, we get streaking artifacts in our image, and we don't get a good picture of the bed, and we get this arc around here. And those are all due to not doing the limited angle case, modeling the limited number of views of the bed properly. Whereas if we take into account the fact that we're missing data. Okay, so let me just get myself calibrated here. So these are all still synthetic data, alternating minimization, 1,000 iterations, 22 ordered subsets, 500 iterations, 22 ordered subsets. We found that we have two methods, and I don't really have time to describe them, but they're just modifications of the iterations I talked about before. In this case, we estimate the missing data, and then we plug it in to the algorithm as if it was the truth. And this is a modified version where we sort of ignore it, but we just, it's hard to describe what method one is. But we got good algorithms, good results for that. So then we said, well, let's run it on the real data. So on the real data, if the board is outside the field of view, we get artifacts in the real data that are very similar to those that we got in our synthetic data. So that's made us confident that we had the right problem. that we identified the problem. And so then the question is, what happens if we run the algorithm, our improvement, and this is what we get with our improved algorithm. So this is the real data with the alternating minimization algorithm not properly accounting for it, and then this is accounting for it. And so we basically get rid of these artifacts due to the bet. This is then going back to that high density metal case, and this is with real data, and this is viewing the line integrals through the metal as being missing. This sort of goes against my religion, which is and Don Snyder often says that when he was growing up in his house, his mother always told him, never throw away data. So this this kind of goes against what Don Snyder's mother told him. This is throwing away the data, and we did this in part because we didn't know the beam hardening correction implemented by the manufacturer, and we got reasonable results with a smaller number of iterations than in our usual method doing this, just viewing that as being missing data. And I think I'm out of time. So, but how much time do I have? 1 minute? All right, so 1 minute. Recently, we've begun working on PET and CT. So this is a PET CT scanner that we have. And it's basically a CT scanner and a PET scanner back to back. And the idea is that they want to view these two data sets at the same time. But what they want is to be able to combine the functional information from PET with the anatomical imaging from CT to try to get good results. But now, in the implementation of the algorithm, the idea is to also, from the CT, estimate the attenuation function. And so then you got your attenuation function at 75 keV. And then you have your PET data, and that's at 511 keV. And what you do is, based upon your image of 75 keV, you estimate the attenuation function at 511. And, okay. This is just talking about that thing. All right. And so you estimate the attenuation function at 511. And so, you know, for soft tissue, you'll get one correction factor. For bone, you get another correction factor. And so, you know, this is, you know, this says 511 versus 80 keV. You use these sort of guesses for what the attenuation function is at these different energies, and then you you'll take this data for CT, and then use that to as the attenuation function in the iterative algorithm for PET, right? So you're using an EM algorithm for PET that does attenuation, that accounts for the attenuation, and the attenuation is estimated from the CT. Well, one of the difficulties is that if you then have a patient with a hip implant, there's these streaking artifacts in what looks like a hole in the side of the patient in the CT. And you use that to estimate the attenuation in PET, and you get streaking artifacts. So your streaking artifacts propagate from your CT into your PET. And so we've just started working on this. None of this, we have not implemented anything. This is just describing the problem. Again, this is another cut to that same patient with the hip implant. And what we'd like to be able to do is to get better images up here in the CT. And then, you can't really see it, but right down here on the PET, it looks like the patient has a hole in his side here. Okay, let me just pick out another one which shows the problem, another version of the problem. Okay, so this is a, when the doctors initially saw this, they thought there might be a cancer up here. Then this might be a metastatic site, and I think this one is a cancer. So they thought this might be, you know, a separate site. But then they looked at it more carefully, and they said, well, this is a metal port that they use for inject, you know, John will tell us what they use it for, but, you know, for putting in chemicals to treat the patient. And it was the errors in the attenuation from here that was used in computing this image that caused this to light up and potentially lead to misdiagnosis. Fortunately, our physicians are smart and they recognize that. Okay, and then there's some experiments that are being done. And so I think I'll just conclude there. So I'll just stop. Okay.
Thank you, Jody.
All right, well, so Jody, this is, I'm going to demonstrate why you shouldn't let physicists out of their cages. I know Don's mom told him not to throw data away, but my mom told me that metals diffract x-rays. And so I don't understand how you could keep that data, because it's completely, it doesn't fit in your model, right? Or am I wrong about metals diffracting x-rays? I mean, is it reasonable to assume that your x-rays just straight line, not only rectilinear, but just don't diffract at all through this metal?
We don't yet, I don't know a good answer, I don't have a good answer to that question. We have looked at various scattering models. We don't usually view them as diffraction models. So if we think about scattering, we'll think about what happens if there's one scatter event. So you go straight line over here, and then there's a scatter, and it comes down and is measured over there. We think about that, and we have enough trouble thinking about that. So, and how you would include that.
That's essentially the same thing. Other questions?
Yeah, sir.
About two-thirds of the way through, you showed three cells up to a million iterations.
Yes.
And when you had, I think it was 122
ordered. 132 ordered substance, yeah.
You got rid of virtually all the streaks except horizontal. Why were those guys not?
The horizontal streaks those are the lines between the two high-density objects.
But to my eye, it looked like there were four high-density objects. So
right, there were four. There were four. So we have a very narrow window around the water, plus or minus 10%. And so that's, as I say, between 0.9 and 1.1, and the highest density object, I think, was 7.
Okay, so those four objects didn't have the same density.
No, there was brass, iron, Teflon, and aluminum. Teflon and aluminum we were able to get without the streaks, and then the brass and the iron, they're so high that you get those streaks. And, you know, I think some of the other speakers talking about, you know, limited angle tomography, if you just view those as being missing, those are actually, you know, along the direction that we have the missing data.
That's great. Just a quick question, a little stupid, but the corners on your metallic object, the radius of curvature is a lot larger than the x-ray wavelength, right? So you probably wouldn't expect too much diffraction, would you?
I'll let Scott answer that question.
are not amorphous. If they have sort of a regular crystalline structure, then it's really the atomic structure of the metal, not necessarily the hard edges.
Uh-huh.
The bulk. It's really crystallography at that point, right? So, but I don't know how much that how wide an angle that gets thrown out at. I really don't feel like that. So.
Yeah.
This is a general question about the use of the EM algorithm.
Yes.
So it is known to converge relatively slowly, and it's at best it converges like a steepest descent algorithm.
Yes.
So we've seen earlier this week Gauss-Newton algorithms, which converge much better than steepest descent algorithms.
Yes.
So why do people use the EM algorithm other than it's being easy to derive and easy to code, perhaps? Rather than use a Gauss-Newton algorithm
with its full-fledged
force and faster convergence.
All right, so that's a good question. And so the Gauss-Newton iterations don't have guaranteed convergence for these algorithms.
Don't you have convexity there in the cost function?
We have convexity in the, so one of our contributions was to lift this problem up to this cost function defined over higher dimensional space, and then in that space viewed over these two variables, then it's convex. So that's one of our contributions, and then viewed, looking at it in that way, then it's convex. And so one of our methods can be thought of as putting surrogate functions over the top. Now, so let me just go back to one of the things you said, in which, all right, so EM algorithms at best converge linearly. And so there's a nice proof, very simple proof, we can write it down in about 2 minutes, that shows that if you converge to an interior point in your region, then you get linear convergence. And the eigenvalue of the convergence is really, the convergence rate is determined by the eigenvalue of product of two matrices, one of which is a Hessian. Okay, so here's the disturbing part about this plot. Okay, this is almost linear. On what scale? Value of the cost function versus log of the iteration number. It's not linear convergence. If it was linear convergence, it would come out here and go, whew, drop through the floor. It doesn't do that. So we got sublinear convergence on this. So that's the disturbing part here. Now, the way that we are working on that. So we got a factor of 100 improvement here, and you know, we'd like to be down here. Every iteration requires two back projections and a number of forward projections equal to the number of, actually, it requires a number of back projections equal, maybe careful, it requires a number twice the number of back projections corresponding to the number of components. And it requires a number of forward projections equal to the number of components in the model. So if it's just one component, it's going to require one forward projection, at least one forward projection, one back projection. All right, so that's the minimum requirement. We have a number of ways that we're trying to get down here, and we've proposed that to NIH, and we're hoping that they'll fund it. But one of our hopes is in multi-grid methods, and we have a generalization of this formulation where we get guaranteed monotonic convergence on multigrid, which I think is nice too.
The other question is about the multi-component scenario. So do you have a proof that you can uniquely recover multiple components from monoenergetic data?
No.
I think you may have counterexamples.
Right. Yes.
Impossible.
Right. Yes. And we actually have data sets, we have dual energy data sets, real data, dual energy data sets, where we're trying to recover two components, and you know, even trying to address the uniqueness there is hard. So the convergence point, as in many EM algorithms, depends upon the initial condition.
I asked me to mention that he'll be driving to the airport immediately at the close of the workshop. And that he has space for several people in his car. How many?
Well, I'm taking Jody right now, and we can put two or three.
Munster, he will speak to us about 3D emission tomography via plane integrals.
Thank you. So the work I want to report on is a joint work with a group